Welcome to Meeting of the Minds, the monthly online book discussion group. This evening we're discussing the novel by Eudora Welty titled The Optimist's Daughter, published in 1972. In 1973, I believe it won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. My name's Tom Peters, and we'll be, for the next few minutes, be talking about this novel. I actually have to begin with a confession. I really kind of struggled with the style of this novel because I'm sighted and I had a printed copy. I read a printed copy. But I don't know, I just sort of seemed out of step with Eudora Welty's style for about the first half of the book. The second half went a little bit smoother for me. I guess I kind of altered my pace a little bit or sort of picked up on her style. Did anyone else struggle with the style of this book at all?
I really did. And I thought probably my problem was the reader. I did not like the reader at all. And I wished I'd read it maybe in Web Braille or something like that because, but I didn't see the point of it, you know. It, and I know it's supposed to be very simple and yet deceivingly simple. And I read all the reviews, but I found it. One, I wondered, I don't think if it were published today, it would be a Pulitzer Prize winner. Does anyone else think so?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if this is maybe a novel that's like an acquired taste, or if Welty's writings are an acquired taste. But I really struggled with it. I read some of the online reviews too, and they talked about, you know, almost a Zen simplicity to it, and I don't know. I think that. I mean, there's something going on in this novel, and hopefully we can kind of tease out some of the major points here. Jill, looks like we just lost Pat, so let's hold up for a minute here.
Where are you finding online reviews of these things? Because I didn't read any online reviews. I just read the Braille, Web Braille copy.
Jill, what I often do is, I'll just maybe like do a Google search for the title of the book and the author's name and see if I can find any online postings about the novel. For this one, I ran across, there was some, I think it's called some kind of group called Constant Reader that had quite a bit of discussion about this novel. Postings back and forth was one source. Sometimes with some of these novels, I'll find other book groups have talked about the same novel, and they'll post like the questions or their discussion topics on the web. So I guess I'm sort of guilty with what a lot of people do is the first thing they do is look on the web for reviews and whatnot.
Guilty. That's just taking advantage of what we now can take advantage of.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can find on the internet these days, and so I always kind of scrounge around and see what I can find about a book or an author that I'm interested in. Jill, did you read the Braille version, or you know, maybe I actually participated in a book discussion last week. I hadn't actually read the book, so I don't want to make you feel embarrassed, but did you get a chance to read the book, and if so, what version did you read?
So I read the Braille version. I read Braille every time if I have a choice, and in this case I had a choice. I get a lot more out of a book. Besides that, if I read talking books, I'm apt to fall asleep and then I have to find my place again. So that's one of the reasons that I read Braille whenever I can. And also, if I like the book, then I can save the book.
Yeah, I tend to read a lot of. I mean, I'm seen to read in a lot of different modes these days. I have quite a few printed books, but also e-books and digital audio books are seem like more and more of my reading I do either electronically or using my ears.
I couldn't believe when books on tape became so popular. You know, we've always had Library of Congress books and we've just taken it for granted. And I said, that just shows you here we've lived with this and none of us blind people saw the potential of books on tape.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I just I was reading a report from the Audio Publishers Association, and they're reporting, I think last year they estimated in the US that audiobooks were, I think it was an $850 million business.
I know a lot of people read them while they're traveling and to and from work. Is that what you do, or do you read them under other conditions as well?
We have a big dog named Max who gets me up at about 5 in the morning and wants to go for a walk. And then I also walk him in the evening. So those are usually a half hour or so walks. And so I work out of my home, so I don't have to commute, thankfully. But usually when I'm walking Max, I'm listening to an audiobook.
I'm back. I guess I got kicked off.
Welcome back, Pat. We're kind of talking about how we were struggling with this book a little bit. I never read another novel by Welty. I'd read some of her short stories. I guess if someone asked me, what's this book about? I would say it's primarily about what I would call the differences between Laura McKelva Hand, the optimist's daughter, and Wanda Faye Chisholm McKelva, her stepmother. And if we could talk about whether that's the central sort of tension within the novel, but I'm wondering what's behind these the differences between these two women? Is it sort of the natural, understandable antagonism between a stepmother and a stepdaughter, or is there something bigger going on here, this in the differences between these two?
I thought that the stepmother was just absolutely an idiot. And according to the book reviews that I read, this book is supposedly to give us an idea of Laura going back and, kind of getting in touch with her past and understanding more about her parents. But, if that's the case, that was certainly a very meager, maybe one chapter or something. I didn't see it personally. And I didn't, yes, there was struggle between the two, but I just thought that this Faye was really not intelligent at all. And the way she treated her husband, apparently tried to kill him, it almost seemed.
Yeah, she's a pretty. I was just trying to think if there's any sort of redeeming qualities to Wanda Faye at all. I mean, she's pretty self-centered, and I don't know. Why do you think that Laurel's father? At one point, they said Laurel said that her father was almost 70 years old when he remarried. Why do you think he married Faye?
This is what I thought too, that really, this man, supposedly an intelligent man, how in the world? But then someone made the remark, he needed to be needed. I mean, I guess he must have if he got a hold of her, because she certainly needed his money and his house and his everything else.
Yeah, she was kind of a gold digger or something, and she's kind of I don't know how to describe it. She's kind of like superficial or something, isn't she? At one point, it's about halfway through the book, Laurel is talking about the Chisholms, and she sees the Chisholms as, and this is a quote, she's as the great as part of the great interrelated family of those who never know the meaning of what has happened to them. I mean, is Wanda Faye like, is she like a type of person who's just kind of goes through life clueless?
Well, I felt she did. I felt she honestly didn't have any purpose in life other than, as you said, or we've said, to, the money and just self-gratification, and just totally flighty and just just mentally not all there.
Yeah, and she seems very, like she's kind of disappointed that she's missing Mardi Gras while her husband's recuperating from eye surgery. And the whole, she doesn't want him to be buried next to his first wife, and buries him off on some kind of, new area of the graveyard that's of the cemetery that's near the interstate. I mean, I don't know. It's is this supposed to be funny or sad or so sad it makes you if you have to sort of laugh to keep from crying?
I think Eudora Welty did a good job of describing types of people that she really was having contact with, and I don't think this woman is really all that unique, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I agree. I think that she really does sort of see Wanda Faye as kind of a type, and even maybe to carry that thought a little bit farther, I wonder if it's almost like Laurel is sort of an old values or, you know, kind of old Southern gentility kind of versus Wanda Faye as like the New South, where at one point near the end of the novel, I think Wanda Faye says about herself, "The past doesn't mean anything to me. I belong to the future." She doesn't sort of care about the past. She just kind of, you know, lives in the present and the future. What's in it for me? I mean, is it too much to say that this is almost like this book is about the struggle between the old genteel South versus the new South?
I don't really know. I didn't, as I read it, I didn't, you know, make that assumption. And yet it seemed like, it's like I was thinking like the father destroyed everything that had to do with his wife. You know, and I, or someone destroyed it. I guess he did. Maybe, I guess it was implied that he did. But I don't know. It, as I said, because I was off for a little while, did anyone read this book as a recording, and the person who read it was as obnoxious as I thought she was?
No, it's not, Jill read the Braille version, and I read the, I got a paperback edition, so I just read the print version. So we've got three different experiences of interacting with this book, too.
Well, I really think that the reader spoiled it for me, in all seriousness, because she tried, you know, she imitated this Faye and made her such a disgusting person, and her voice and attempting to pick up all the dialect, and it was just, well, terribly overdone. And it was the NLS version that I read also, that I read, not Audible or anything like that.
Well, I think Faye came up, I mean, Faye is just not an attractive person at all, based on my reading, too. I mean, she just, I can't see anything where I'd say, oh, I sort of understand, you know, yeah, Faye was in a difficult position as being the late in life second wife of this judge. I mean, I didn't have any sympathy for her at all. And her family was just, you know, when they came over from Texas for the funeral, I mean, I'm sort of struggling with what, you know, is this, did Welty really want us to see this as a laugh out loud kind of comedy or kind of a dark comedy? I mean, the whole thing is, the whole funeral, which sort of occupies the middle part of the book, is, it's not deeply spiritual, it seems to me. It's more just, you know, kind of silly stuff that goes on at funerals and strange snippets of conversation, and some people are drunk, and it's just more comic than tragic.
Well, it certainly appeared to me to be that way, too. And it, as you indicated a while ago, the burial site was hilarious. And really, that the sound of the traffic on the freeway was so loud that they couldn't even hardly hear the minister. But it didn't seem to be reverent in any sense of the word. And it seemed that Laurel took exception to some of the comments that were being made about her father, that she wanted people to think well of him. I don't know if that's anyone else got that opinion or not.
Yeah, I did too. And, you know, until the, I don't know what to make of Laurel either. I mean, I guess she was the only child of this, I forget, her mother's name was Becky, and Clint McKelva. But and then she married, I guess he was a Navy man who was killed in combat during World War II by a kamikaze pilot in the Pacific, less than a year after they were married. And she's currently a fabric designer, if I remember correctly, in Chicago. Of course, grew up in this small town in Mississippi. But you know what? What should we make of Laurel? Is she, you know, does she have a, does she have much gumption?
Well, I think she's this refined Southern type that we talked about. I mean, that's what she was. And obviously, she had all these friends from the small town, so she must have been well liked as a growing up woman.
Right, her she refers to them as her bridesmaids, although you sort of have to assume that this novel is the action of the novel is set in the early 70s, so you know she's probably been a widow for 25 years at the time of this novel, but she still refers to all her friends as her bridesmaids.
Well, she didn't fit. I don't think she, I, you know, we don't know if she fit in Chicago, but I didn't think she fit in this small Mississippi area at all.
Yeah, so it's in a way this is kind of her father's illness and death was almost like a forced homecoming for her. And I don't know, Pat, you were saying earlier that you know is this novel basically about Laurel having to sort of confront her upbringing and her parents' world? I don't know if I got much of a sense of that. I mean, I'm still kind of struggling with what was this novel about?
Yeah, I'm glad you think that too, Tom, because I just kept shaking my head looking for the point. But you know, I did not understand why she did not read the letters, why she didn't save the letters that she found in her mother's cabinet that apparently Faye had not destroyed or the father had not destroyed. You know, she didn't seem to want, as Chris we said, she, you know, only lived in the past, I mean in the present and the future. But I would have thought that she would have wanted to have looked at those letters. I mean, if she cared about her parents, I don't think it would have been snooping or, you know, infringing upon their love for each other. But maybe she thought they didn't. I don't know, and was afraid of that.
Yeah, she burned them all, didn't she? After she found them, after that, she spent that night sort of trapped in the house with that bird that was trapped in the house. I mean, didn't she burn them the next morning?
Yes, she did.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit odd, too, that she just didn't show much interest in them. She just wanted almost like destroyed that final bit of evidence about them. And then, you know, the other thing that sort of that last part of the book is, remember, she finds that breadboard kind of tucked away in one of the cupboards, and she's, man, the breadboard kind of sets something off in her, and she really kind of lashes out over at Faye about the breadboard, and Laurel, she says she sees the whole story, the whole solid past is sort of right there in that breadboard and what happened to it.
I thought that was a kind of a strange scene, and I wasn't sure what to make of it.
Yeah, it's like, well, what I remember was that her husband had made that breadboard for her mother, like made it from scratch, you know, with the tongue and groove or the doweling and everything, and sort of really had made it as a labor of love. And her mother had used it to make some of the best bread in town. And then Faye had sort of abused it, and had, I think Faye said that she'd been pounding walnuts to open up walnuts on it and gouged it and everything and scratched it up. And so here's this object that for Laurel was really tied intimately with her husband and her mother, now both long dead. She finds it in this house that's gone, going, the house she grew up in is going to go to this this kind of unthinking, selfish, superficial stepmother of hers, and she just kind of explodes, it seems like, right there at the end.
But what I found interesting was, because I couldn't figure out how this thing was going to end, And yet here, Laurel, after this big explosion and this whole thing centers around this breadboard, is able to just walk away basically and say, you know, what difference does it make? I didn't expect that.
Yeah, I agree. That took me back too. Sort of the burning of the letters and then this big fight over the breadboard. Then she kind of goes, oh, I don't care, you know. I just don't. It kind of made me wonder, you know, has Laurel sort of learned anything in the course of the events described in this novel? I mean, does she go back to Chicago, you know, older and wiser? I just didn't get that sense that she had sort of seen into the heart of anything and sort of taken away any wisdom with her. I don't know. What did you think?
That was the part that confused me, that the reviewers felt that she went back to get a meaning to her past. But if that's the case, they saw something in this book that I didn't, and I didn't think she got any meaning except maybe that the heck with it, you know, just forget it and walk away.
It kind of makes me wonder how she lived out the rest of her life, if she just sort of became a recluse or what happened to her.
The author didn't write any sequels?
Not that I know of. You know, the other thing, I always take titles of books, I take them seriously and sort of think about, you know, why is this book called The Optimist's Daughter? Does that mean that she, the optimist is clearly, I mean, in the course of the novel, her father several times is referred to as an optimist. I think when he has his eye surgery, or was it his mother? Her mother had eye surgery. Whatever his surgery was there in New Orleans. He's, at one point, I think Laurel says that he was an optimist about it and figured that he would recover well. And then later in the novel, Laurel observes that her father began to scowlingly refer to himself as an optimist, beginning from the moment when his dying first wife called him Lucifer and a liar. So it's kind of like, you know, was he really an optimist, or is that just sort of like a tongue-in-cheek aspect of it? Because he did sort of give up in his recovery, it seemed like, and just almost, you know, gave up on life. And then the other thing, you know, so whenever there's a book like called The Optimist's Daughter, every time the word optimism is used in the novel, I sort of pay attention and say, well, how are they using this? The other thing I noticed was that Phil Hand, who was Laurel's husband, long deceased, Laurel once writes about him that he was not an optimist. So, you know, in what sense was Laurel the optimist's daughter? Was she more of a daddy's girl than a mama's girl? Or, I mean, does she identify more with her father? Or what does that mean, the optimist's daughter?
I thought about that too throughout the book, and I'll have to admit, I just decided it was a poor title.
That, I guess that's always, I guess that's always a possibility. Is it just a poorly titled book?
I don't mean to be disrespectful, but you know, I didn't see it. I mean, if we're talking about optimists being that her father was an optimist, and he didn't seem to be too optimistic. And she certainly wasn't. And of course, Pei, I don't know. I couldn't tell if she had any optimism or any brain matter at all. So really, in all seriousness, I didn't understand the title of the book at all. I thought it was poorly named, unless I was missing something very important.
Well, I too am still struggling with, you know, what does that mean, the optimist's daughter? You know, the thing that struck me about this novel is that it could almost have been a stage play. You know, there are so few scenes. You know, all you really need is like the hospital, the house at the time of the, you know, prior to the funeral, the funeral home, the graveside, back to the house. It really could have been like a three-act play. Did it seem sort of like dramatic in that sense, or almost like it could have been a play?
I think one of Eudora Welty's gifts is her ability to do dialogue. I hadn't thought about it as a play, but you know, she really could have written plays because so much of her stories are the same type of interchange dialogue, and you really feel like it's just as accurate as can be, and that you're right there among them.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, we've been sort of laughing about not understanding this novel, but I think that you really did. I did feel like I was at this, you know, I was at the house with everybody there, and you know, funerals that I have attended, I consider it resonated with funerals that I had attended in my lifetime. I really felt like I was there, and it was like, you know, I'm maybe the sort of the mysterious Zen-like, as one reviewer said or commentator said, aspect of this novel is it's like, as you sort of try to figure out what's going on here, what's the meaning of this. In one sense, you might say, well, it's hidden, but in another sense, you could say, well, it's right there. You know, it's just a mundane portrayal of this guy's death and his burial and how his daughter and the town and his second wife deal with it. And it's not. The language isn't sort of highfalutin, and it's very, very realistic, I guess I'd say. What do you think about that?
And remember the scene in the hospital where she's actually, after she's been sent out of her father's room when he's really dying, and she's there where these people are all gathered because of the man who'd been the roommate of her father. He was having his surgery, and these people are all there. And then later they make the comparison, or somebody makes a remark, these are just like the people that are Faye's family. So you certainly get this picture. This is one type of Southerner, and Laurel and the people in the little town of Mississippi are the other type.
Yeah, I tend to agree, Jill. I think that, you know, it's like I don't know how to describe it. I don't know whether it's, you know, whether it's socioeconomic terms or cultural, but it's like you know, one way to think about what happened to that fu at the house before the funeral was like a culture clash, you know, two different southern subcultures trying to interact and just not succeeding.
Well, those comments add more to probably helping to understand the book than I think what I have been thinking as I read it and as I've thought about it since I've read. And this idea of a three-act play, that's kind of interesting, and I certainly see how that could occur, you know, could really be a way that this could have been portrayed. Well, the story did go from start to finish, I guess, but somehow there didn't seem to be a thread. Well, I guess there was, but because Faye kept interrupting, you know, she was involved in all of it, but it just seemed like it was pretty disjointed, or I mean, that it was the emphasis at first was on the father, then sort of on the father, but at a funeral. And then at the end, the father and his belongings, and then what Laurel found of the breadboard and that kind of thing. So there seemed to be something I was missing, I'm afraid.
Well, Pat, I agree with you though. I mean, I just I don't know how to describe it, but it like kept me off balance as a reader. It was always like I just felt like I wasn't really I didn't feel comfortable while I read it. I don't know how to describe it, but it's you know, some people really sort of like that feeling like they're at odds with the book they're reading, like the book is. They see that as a challenging book. I just didn't feel like I was in tune with the book. You know, I don't know if I'm describing myself well, but it just bothered me as I read it because I didn't feel like, you know, I guess I don't really feel like I know Laurel. Having read this book, I don't really feel like I know her very well.
And I can't truly say that this was a good read. Now, before, we've had books that, you know, we've questioned a little and I've not been as enthused about, but I had a totally different feeling about this book. I didn't even think it was a good read.
Yeah, I just don't know if this is one of those books that maybe if you reread it a few years from now. I remember one person I read whose comment said that they'd read it about 12, first time, and then 12 years later they read it again and they got much more out of it the second time. I don't know, it was kind of an interest, I don't know, it's an interesting book, kind of frustrating in a way. And one of some other things, remember that the housekeeper, her name's Missouri, and I don't know if it's actually stated, but I sort of assumed that she was black. What did you make of Missouri? Was she a well-defined character? Some of the other characters in the book, there's that kind of comic character, Colonel Rupert Bullock, who's always he's the one who sort of brought the Chisholms over here from Texas for the funeral. What did you make of some of these other characters in the novel? Were they pretty well articulated or not?
I thought so. In this, Missouri obviously was black, and she, I can't remember how she was brought into the family. Something happened, didn't it, that the judge kind of rescued her from a situation? I've forgotten what it was, but yeah, and she'd been with them forever, which is very typical, of the South in the day, Eudora Welty's day. I mean, they had these people that were there for years, and even well after I was in the South, actually, in the late 1940s, and it's amazing how much of this seems so familiar to me.
Yeah, I can't remember what the story was about Missouri. Did she have, an illegitimate child or something, or was she in some sort of legal trouble as a young woman, and somehow the judge sort of brought her into the household to sort of give her a chance, and then she ended up staying there for years and years and decades? I can't remember. There was some sort of story about how she came into their lives.
I'm afraid I don't even remember. I remember a character named Missouri, but she didn't stand out apparently as, and I don't even remember the circumstances. And the fact that the way it was read, in fact, all of the characters sounded black. And I wasn't sure that was really the way they, with no disrespect, but I mean, I wasn't sure that was the way it was supposed to come off, that I was supposed to get that impression.
Yeah, I don't know, that's interesting. I was operating under the assumption that all the characters in the novel were white except Missouri. And I don't know much about, Southern Presbyterianism, but I think several times they talk about sort of Laurel and the bridesmaids and sort of that culture that is represented there is sort of being the Southern Presbyterian culture, and I don't know what Wanda Faye and her family represent, if they're I don't know, Southern Baptist. I don't think they were sort of, their religious affiliation was mentioned in the novel, but it seemed like several times they refer to Laurels, the McKelvas, as being Presbyterians.
And I think for the most part, the Presbyterian faith in the South during that time was probably primarily white. But the dialect, even today, if you listen to someone speaking in the true Southern style, it's difficult. Even the Texas sometimes, it's difficult to discern race. And of course, I think that's a good thing, because that shouldn't be a real problem. But in this book, I couldn't really identify, but I just don't know much about Missouri. Jill might remember more.
Okay, and a whole other aspect of this novel, and we're running out of time, and it sounds like none of us were really, ecstatic over this novel, so I won't belabor it too much. But, a whole other confusing area to me was, sort of what represent that mountain in West Virginia where Laurel's mother's family grew up, and sort of what that represents, and the fact that Laurel's mother Becky sort of left her family in West Virginia and moved all the way out to Mississippi, and it's almost like, even though the action of the novel takes place in New Orleans and Mount Salus, Mississippi, I think an argument could be made that that mountain in West Virginia is really kind of the geographic center or the novel. What did you make of that whole, all those scenes that were mention of West Virginia and the sort of the family roots?
At the moment, they do not stand out in my mind at all. So I obviously was not paying that much attention, I'm afraid.
Well, let me throw another confusing aspect for me anyway. I'm not sure what to make of Laurel's mother, Becky. I mean, I'm sort of, if someone asked me, was she a nice person or a not so nice person, or a good person or a not so good person? I'm not sure how I would answer. In her final illness, she seemed pretty, she had some pretty unkind words for her husband and her daughter. I don't know if we should forgive that because she was in her final illness, or, what did you make of Laurel's mother based on what you know of her coming out of this novel? Did she leave any kind of an impression on you?
Well, I didn't think that her daughter thought much of her, and again, the way she destroyed her mother's things, the things that might, would have been considered very dear, and if you had much love for a parent, I think, even though, again, if she might not have wanted to have read the letters, she might wanted to have kept them or kept some of the other things. I think Laura was a bit detached from both of them.
That's a good point. And, something else I just thought of. Remember if she spends the night with that bird trapped in the house, and I think there's a storm that night, a thunderstorm, and she's sort of thinking about her past and her parents and everything. And then the next morning, that kind of handyman guy comes and it just happens to knock at the door. And I guess he comes by about every spring and is going to fix things up a little bit. And he makes a comment about something about how Laurel now is all alone in the world, that she has no, immediate relatives and no siblings, no parents are both dead, estranged from her stepmother. Is that what this novel's all about? Is here Laurel's now confronting the fact that she's sort of all alone in the world now? Husband's dead. She's just got her job in Chicago.
Well, that could really be. As I think back, I remember, that particular comment being made. I didn't think so much about it at the time, but as I think about it now, that really could be that everything was now gone, and she really was alone. And then, of course, the question is, what is she going to do about it?
Yeah, it's just such an enigmatic novel, you just kind of, I don't know how much mental effort I want to put into sort of scratching my head and saying, what was that about? What was that all about? And, that final scene where she's, her bridesmaids are taking her back to the airport. And of course, she's flying back to Chicago where all her memories are about taking the train. It's all about taking the train. Now she's flying back. And then the school children all wave goodbye to her departing vehicle. Is that sort of the future waving goodbye to her? Or, it's almost like a pretty heavy symbolism. Or is it just that's just what happened and that's the final scene?
It seems to be the final scene. In other words, it doesn't leave room for her returning or any kind of a feeling that she will return, either on her part or on the friends and the children and all. It just seems like, they're really saying goodbye.
Yeah, I got the same sense that she's not going to be making many trips back to Mount Solace, Mississippi.
But Tom, what makes this book considered to be a classic? A classic in American literature? I don't believe that I'm knowledgeable enough to know, what determines classics as opposed to a term we might use otherwise. And I just kind of can't put it. I think of like Dickens, The Christmas Carol, and a lot of things that Dickens wrote really are classics. But I can't see this book fitting in that. So maybe someone else can. Maybe you or Jill can help.
I don't know if I can help because, actually, sometimes I read an author and based on what I know of that author, I feel like I should be inclined to appreciate their works as classics or really profound. And this has happened to me with other authors, and for whatever reason, I just don't get it, or I just don't feel like I'm in tune with that author. I don't share that author's way of looking at the world, or you know, there maybe there's some stylistic things that I just can't get around or whatever it is. And I always sort of feel like I'm inadequate or as a reader, because so many people say, oh, you know, Eudora Welty, her works are great. And yeah, I didn't think it was a bad novel, but maybe that understatement is a whole sort of style that, I don't know if you would call it modernism or, you know, it's certainly not Dickensian, and her writing style is nowhere like Dickens.
This is why I was asking you where you were reading reviews, because the way I felt when I finished that book was, I need somebody to tell me why this book is considered a real classic. So if you find a source, Pat, you let me know, and if I find a source, I'll let you know.
Okay, well, actually, I'm kind of looking forward to putting this aside and picking up Ethan Frome.
I haven't read that one, but it sounds a lot better than this. And if Jill thinks it's good, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, I haven't read it either, but Jill, you really liked it, right? So I'm looking forward to reading that one. I think that's going to be more sort of my style.
The way I felt about Ethan Frome was, it's the kind of thing you read it and you can't forget it, and yet you don't know why you feel that way. And so here again, I want someone to tell me why this always appears on classic lists. So don't use me as an authority, you guys.
Oh, Jill, here I thought it was for a different reason. Seriously, I think that's the kind of the fun thing of reading some of these books, because, you know, we all have different tastes, but I think it's really good to read something that other people think is good. And then, you know, like Tom said, I kind of question myself when people think it's so wonderful and I can't, you know, I can't figure it out, or just totally kind of disjointed, at least from the book, or just not a part of it at all. So I'll look forward to Ethan Frome to see how I like it.
Well, you know, I'm an old English major, and so, you know, I always try to not let literature sort of bowl me over, you know, its reputation bowl me over. I mean, I think, you know, one way to read this Eudora Welty novel is it could almost be read as a laugh out loud, funny, you know, kind of comic novel about the way people really behave when someone passes away. I mean, there are a lot of funny scenes, a lot of funny little incidents in the novel, but it's almost like it's a dark comedy, or the overall tone of the book you don't feel like you want to laugh out loud at some of these scenes, but as I think back on them, they were pretty funny.
I think so too, and you know, maybe that's what the reader was trying to convey. I don't know. I wish both of you would just give a listen to a chapter or two, because it just gave a funny slant, not necessarily humorous, but a strange slant to the whole book. And I didn't know, you know, if it was the dialect, if it was reader trying to, or whether she really thought it was funny, I guess, I mean, humorous. But there were some really funny scenes in it. There really were.
Well, let's put this book aside and pick up Ethan Frome, and let's discuss that next month. And then in February, we'll discuss The Difference That Disability Makes, which I'm kind of anxious to read, because we haven't read a book, a nonfiction work about disability, the general subject of disability. I think it's a Canadian author who wrote that book. So I'm anxious to read and discuss that. And then in March, we'll read what I think. I've read this novel, and I'll go out on a limb. I think it's a pretty good novel, The Known World, which is just published, I think, last year or 2002. And it's won some awards. And it's a historical novel, too. So hopefully, David Fauché will be able to, you know, be inclined to participate and comment on it as a historical novel. So I think hopefully we've got a good lineup for the next 3 months here of good reads, Pat and Jill.
I think so too. I was wondering if there was any way, we talk about increasing participation, if there was any way that we could encourage libraries to do what the Cleveland Public Library is doing with their book discussions, having a number of people in the library around a computer. And I guess that would take probably more than I realize in you know, planning or organizing, because it has to be a social event, I guess. But I just wondered if you thought, Tom, that that was even a possibility within any of the Opal libraries, or even if any of the others, that we could be encouraged to do that. It makes those book discussions more interesting. I was really fascinated with the Da Vinci Code, and then with this Skipping Christmas, because they really got into that book, and they did the same thing with the Da Vinci Code, and I'm sure they're going to with the other book in February. But, you know, I just wondered if there was some way we could help to encourage our libraries to do that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll try to. And I've been, you know, I still think this is a great idea to have a monthly book discussion, online book discussion. And, you know, for this discussion, I found two societies that are devoted to Eudora Welty and sent messages to both directors. Never heard back from either one of them. And, you know, we tried having those Nebraska graduate students for the, I forget the author's name now, it just slipped my mind, but we keep trying things to try to get more people involved and have livelier discussions. I'll keep trying. I'll try maybe see if we can get some libraries to get some small groups huddled around a computer to join us in the discussions.
Here in Indiana, we don't have much going for us as far as the not the director, I guess, but well, the librarian, the head librarian of our Talking Book Center. But the director of that library, of our Indiana library, is really quite progressive and is relatively new on the job. But I was thinking that through osmosis or somehow might be able to encourage them, even though they're not a part of Opal, but to encourage them to do it. But I'm fearful that they would also think this was just too much of a interference with their daily work.